So this evening then, we're considering another Ethiopian eunuch. If you were here last Sunday morning, you may recall that I rebranded the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts chapter 8, the Sudanese statesman. That title doesn't fit quite so well this time. I mean, this guy is from the same place. He too is Sudanese in terms of our 21st century maps. But I don't think he's really a statesman. He's more like the eunuchs that we encounter in the book of Esther. I talked about that last Sunday. He's a medium level royal official, I think. He's not like that Chancellor of the Exchequer that Philip encountered that day in the desert. But actually, of course, we don't need a title at all for this particular man, because unlike the one in Acts 8, he's given a name here in the scriptures. He's called Ebed-Melech. And he then is our next obscure Old Testament hero. That's our Sunday evening series. We look in at various people who fall into that category, obscure Old Testament heroes. And Ebed-Melech then is fairly obviously, I think, a hero. He's a hero because of his intervention on behalf of the prophet Jeremiah, as the latter is probably dying a slow and lonely death, stuck in mud at the bottom of a deep cistern. And so this evening then, I just want to notice three simple things about this intervention. First of all, this evening, the timing of his intervention. The timing of his intervention. And I suppose it's very easy for us to say, well, the timing of Ebed-Melech's intervention is splendid. I mean, we're told, aren't we, in verse 7, that he heard that they had put Jeremiah into the cistern. So it's not then that this cistern happens to be right next to Ebed-Melech's daily commute to work, so that he was just bound to see Jeremiah languishing down there, or at least hear Jeremiah shout as he went to work the next morning, and he was bound to come across Jeremiah quickly. No, not at all. He remains ignorant, it seems, of Jeremiah's fate until he just happens to hear some talk somewhere. Do you know what's happened to Jeremiah? He's been put down a cistern. Now suppose then he hadn't happened to hear. Or suppose he hadn't happened to hear about Jeremiah for a week, or for 2 weeks, or for a month. Then he would almost certainly have rushed to that cistern, only to find a corpse slumped there in the mud. And so we can easily say then, well, the timing's great. Ebed-Melech hears and intervenes while Jeremiah is still alive and still well enough to make a good recovery once he's been lifted out of the cistern. So as I say, it's easy for us to conclude from our vantage point this evening, well, the timing here is just wonderful. The timing is splendid. I'm not sure Jeremiah would perhaps feel quite so cheerful about the timing here. I mean, he might well have thought, well, why couldn't Ebed-Melech have intervened a bit earlier? Like before he was ever put in the cistern at all. We have other biblical interventions of that kind, don't we? You think of the Apostle Paul and how in Acts 23 there are 40 plus Jews who hate him and who are determined they're going to kill him. And they have planned then this ambush. They're going to ambush Paul on the road. And Paul, of course, in that chapter, he has an Ebed-Melech, doesn't he? Come and intervene on his behalf. It's his nephew, his sister's son. But in his case, the intervention isn't after the ambush has happened, and while Paul is kind of being mistreated by these Jews who have now captured him. No, they don't even get to the point of capturing him. Before the ambush ever takes place, the nephew hears the conspiracy, reports it to a soldier, and the whole plan comes to nothing. Paul never has to suffer on that instance, the, dis- the distress of being ambushed and being captured by his enemies. And obviously Jeremiah doesn't know the story of the Apostle Paul, but if he did, he might well have thought, well, why couldn't my intervention from Ebed-Melech have been like that one? And it's the question then for us this evening, why not? We confess that God is in control of all these things. God is in control of everything. We've been singing and praying about that already in our service this evening. Why couldn't God have got Ebed-Melech to intervene a bit earlier so that Jeremiah wouldn't have had to go in the pit at all? Why couldn't Ebed-Melech have been there on that day when the conspirators asked Zedekiah for permission to put Jeremiah in the cistern? And why couldn't Ebed-Melech at that point have used his persuasive powers to say to Zedekiah, no, this is evil, this shouldn't happen, this is wrong, this is unjust? Why does Jeremiah have to spend however long it was languishing in that pit first before Ebed-Melech comes along? Well, of course, God isn't obliged to share his reasons for these things with us, and he doesn't particularly share his reasons here in our passage, except that I think we do get at least one little hint of one reason why perhaps Ebed-Melech's intervention wasn't earlier than it actually was. You see, in the second half of chapter 38, this is after the intervention, after the deliverance of Jeremiah from the cistern. And we have this fascinating meeting, don't we, between Jeremiah and King Zedekiah. Zedekiah is the king of Judah. And the historical context here is that the Babylonians are besieging Jerusalem. They have arrived on the doorstep. They are there surrounding the city. Nebuchadnezzar, the most powerful man on the planet, and his feared troops, they are there surrounding the city of Jerusalem. That's the context. And Zedekiah then, he wants to know what the Lord's counsel is at this critical point. And that's why then he arranges this meeting with Jeremiah. And Jeremiah then is clear, isn't he, what the Lord's counsel is. Zedekiah must surrender, verse 17. Thus says the Lord, the God of hosts, the God of Israel, if you will surrender to the officials of the king of Babylon, then your life shall be spared. This city shall not be burned with fire, and you and your house shall live. So he's clear on what Zedekiah must do. And then he's also clear on the consequences if Zedekiah doesn't do that. If Zedekiah refuses to surrender to Nebuchadnezzar. And that's in verses 18 to 23. And in that connection then, he shares this intriguing little vision that the Lord has given him there in verse 22. This vision, it concerns then the day that the walls of Jerusalem are breached. So it's envisaging Zedekiah has refused to surrender. And it's backfired on him, and the walls of Jerusalem have now been breached, and the Babylonians are in the process of ransacking the city. And it's described there in verse 22, these women being led out. It seems this is the royal harem or something. It's not Zedekiah's wife or wives, because they're mentioned separately in verse 23. This is, it seems, the royal harem being led out of the city by the Babylonians. And we have these women then, these concubines, these women in the harem, and they are kind of taunting Zedekiah as they're being led out by the Babylonians, and they're taunting him for his utter helplessness now in this situation. Here's this man Zedekiah, and for years he's been taking refuge in the promises of his allies. On the one hand, oh, we'll come to your help and we'll rescue you from the Babylonians. And then from the promises of the false prophets on the other hand, oh, don't worry, Jerusalem will be fine. The Lord will preserve Jerusalem. Nobody will ever attack Jerusalem. And Zedekiah has been taking great refuge in all these promises from his allies, from the false prophets. And these promises have all come to nothing on this day. And so these women kind of taunting him They picture him with his feet sunk in the mud and all his friends walking away. That's the picture in that verse of four lines there in verse 22. It's an image of the most desolate, terrifying kind of helplessness. You're stuck in mud. You can't move. You can't run. You can't escape. And your friends, your only hope of any help, are walking away from you. It's a desperate, desperate picture. But this is the thing then. How do you imagine Jeremiah delivered that line? That line in verse 22, the line about being your feet being sunk in the mud. Do you think he just delivered that line coldly and dispassionately, in a detached manner? I don't think so. I expect he delivered that line with tears in his eyes, because he knew literally that kind of helplessness, didn't he? From his own very recent experience. Perhaps indeed what we have here is an abbreviated form of what he said. Perhaps he went into more detail about the helplessness of being stuck in mud and you can't move your limbs and you can't get a foothold and you're desperately trying to get out and you can't. And the point I'm trying to make then is that here perhaps we have at least one reason why Jeremiah had to be in that pit at all, why Ebed-Melech didn't intervene earlier in God's plan. It was so that Jeremiah might be able to minister more effectively to Zedekiah on this day. He might be able to more vividly describe the sort of helplessness that Zedekiah was going to feel on the day the Babylonians invaded. Because he himself had been in such a situation of helplessness at the bottom of that cistern. And isn't that often perhaps a reason why God delays the Ebed-Melechs in our lives? Why God doesn't intervene through an Ebed-Melech earlier? Why he allows us to suffer? Why he allows difficult situations to be played out and played out in our lives? You see, when it comes to this whole issue of suffering, on the one hand, we can view it, if we want, as utterly meaningless. It's either just randomly decreed by a God who doesn't care, or perhaps not even decreed by God at all, because God doesn't have any control over our suffering. We can view it like that, if we like, that our suffering is just meaningless. Then again, we can view it as a meaningful providence that will actually ultimately do us good. And I guess for most of us, we call ourselves Reformed Christians, that's probably where we would be often. And we sing about that in William Cooper's hymn about the clouds breaking in blessings on our heads. These sufferings, they will ultimately work out for our good. We might not be able to see how that will be, but we trust it, we believe it, they will ultimately work out for our good. Actually, the Bible, I think, goes further than that, doesn't it? And it encourages us to view our sufferings not merely as a meaningful providence that will ultimately do us good, but as a meaningful providence that will ultimately do others good through us. Think of Paul's language in 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 3 onwards. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our affliction, so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. For as we share abundantly in Christ's suffering, so through Christ we share abundantly in comfort too. If we are afflicted, it is for your comfort and salvation. You think of that woman, Anna, in Luke chapter 2. Fascinating little paragraph, isn't it, about her The baby Jesus is there being taken by his parents to the temple. And there's that rather sudden and rather shocking encounter with Simeon. And Simeon's words, remember, really it seems putting a dampener on the whole occasion. Simeon blessed them and said to Mary his mother, "Behold, this child is appointed for the fall and rising of many in Israel, and for a sign that is opposed, and a sword will pierce through your own soul also." Imagine, there's Mary, and she's so full of joy having this baby, and then she encounters this old man in the temple, and he said, "Look, because of this child, a sword is going to pierce your soul." Must have been pretty shocking for her. And yet then, in the very next verse, we're told this, "And there was a prophetess, Anna, the daughter of Phanuel of the tribe of Asher. She was advanced in years, having lived with her husband 7 years from when she was a virgin, and then as a widow until she was 84. She did not depart from the temple, worshipping with fasting and prayer night and day. And coming up at that very hour, she began to give thanks to God and to speak of him to all who were waiting for the redemption of Jerusalem." Is it any coincidence, I wonder, that in that moment when Mary must have been shocked and distressed and disconcerted by what she just heard from Simeon, who at that very moment, Luke stresses, should turn up but this woman, Anna, who has suffered for so many years. She's been a widow, and it's not clear how long exactly, but clearly for a long, long time. She's been a widow for decades and decades and decades. And is it not suggesting perhaps that she was the perfect person to bump into Mary at that moment, to be able to bring comfort in the way God had comforted her over years of loss? She was able to share some of that comfort with this young woman who was reeling from what Simeon had just said to her. And I'm saying then that our sufferings, yes, they are for our own good, but they're also for the good of others, aren't they? God sends difficult things into our lives for the blessing of others. And that, I think, is what we see a little bit of here with Jeremiah. He's in this pit, and because he's in the pit, he's able to minister more effectively to Zedekiah just a day or two later. So that's the first thing then, the timing of his intervention. But then notice with me, secondly, the motive of his intervention. The motive of his intervention. Now, it's not simply then that he's a kindly soul, and that's why he intervenes and rescues Jeremiah. Now, we meet people all the time, don't we, who are just kindly souls, and they might be atheists, they might be Muslims, they might be Hindus, they might be Jehovah's Witnesses, and yet they are kindly folk, and they are helpful, and they go out of their way to do things for others. And we should thank God, shouldn't we, that he does put those instincts within people. Imagine what the world would be like if everybody was actually as self-centered as their beliefs should make them. It would be a pretty terrifying world, wouldn't it? But this man then, Ebed-Melech, it's not just that he's just naturally and by temperament then a kindly soul. We are told, aren't we, quite explicitly in chapter 39, verse 18, why Ebed-Melech did what he did. It's fascinating, that paragraph there. We seem to have gone beyond Ebed-Melech. We seem to have left him behind. We seem to have moved on. But suddenly Ebed-Melech pops up again at the end of chapter 39. And he's promised by God that on the day that the walls are breached, that he will be spared. We have these two men at least who will be spared. Jeremiah, we're told that in the previous paragraph. But Ebed-Melech will be also. And he's going to be spared then because, verse 18, he has put his trust in me. He's put his trust in Yahweh. So at some point then, Ebed-Melech had ended up in Judah, as we've already said. He's from Sudan. But at some point, through some set of circumstances, he's ended up in Judah. But more than that, he's become a worshipper then of Judah's God, of Yahweh. And he then, it seems, has gotten into the law of Yahweh at a time when probably most people in Judah cared very little for it. He was a man who took the Torah seriously. And while there was no specific stipulation then in the law of Moses that if a man is in mud at the bottom of a cistern, you should get ropes and get him out, nonetheless, it did say in the law of Moses, love your neighbor as yourself. And we know, don't we, from Jesus' interpretation of that in Luke chapter 10, in one of his most famous parables. We know that the scope of love your neighbor as yourself extended to helping an injured man who had been beaten and left half naked on the roadside. And presumably then, love your neighbor as yourself also extended to helping a man who has been left at the bottom of a pit. And Ebed-Melech, then, he seems to understand that. He's a man who trusts in the Lord, who worships the true God, and who takes his law seriously, and love your neighbor as yourself seriously, and that then is his motive as he goes to the rescue of Jeremiah. But then you might say, well, if that's the case, why does it use the word trust here? Why does God say, because you've put your trust in me? Why not because you obeyed me on that day when you pulled Jeremiah out? You were obeying my law. Love your neighbor as yourself. Why is the emphasis on trust rather than on obedience? Well, I think this is probably the reason. Look at what we're told in verse 17 there of chapter 39. There's a reference, isn't there, to these men of whom you are afraid. Who are these men? Well, almost certainly they are the anti-Jeremiah party, the people who put Jeremiah in the cistern in the first place. And there are plenty of them. There are the men who actually did that, but they probably just the tip of the iceberg. There were lots of people who hated Jeremiah. He wasn't a popular guy. And these people then who hate Jeremiah and who have conspired to have Jeremiah put down the cistern, they're not going to be too pleased at Ebed-Melech turning up and taking Jeremiah back out again. Isn't that why Zedekiah, when telling Ebed-Melech to go and do the deed, he says, take 30 men with you. Now, do you really need 30 men to pull one prophet out of a cistern? I doubt it. It's probably they were there as security guards, because this was dangerous what Ebed-Melech was doing. There were people who would not want Jeremiah back out of that cistern. And even once he'd managed to pull it off and get Jeremiah out of the cistern, there would be people who now would have their eye on Ebed-Melech and would not like Ebed-Melech and might target Ebed-Melech because of what he'd done. In other words, then, for Ebed-Melech, rescuing Jeremiah from the cistern, it wasn't just a case of straightforward obedience. The law says, love your neighbor as yourself, therefore I'll go and I'll take Jeremiah out because that's showing love to him. Ebed-Melech had to demonstrate a lot of trust in that situation. He had to trust God that his commands are good, that his commands, like love your neighbor as yourself, are the best course of action, even when they are accompanied by significant dangers. Doing this was a dangerous thing for Ebed-Melech. It was really putting his head above the parapet, making himself a target for dangerous men in the land of Judah. And so Ebed-Melech just had to trust God that doing what the law said, doing what God had stipulated, that was the best thing, the right thing, the good thing, even when accompanied by significant dangers. I think actually we have a contrast in chapters 38 and 39. This is one of the reasons I read so much earlier in our service. It seems strange, doesn't it, that this paragraph about Ebed-Melech being spared, it comes right at the end of chapter 39. Why does it come there? Well, I think a contrast has been set up here between Ebed-Melech and Zedekiah. You see, here's Zedekiah, and he has a command from God, doesn't he? There in chapter 38, God tells him to surrender to Nebuchadnezzar. That's the command through Jeremiah to Zedekiah, surrender to Nebuchadnezzar. And he too is afraid. We're told that quite explicitly in verse 19 of chapter 38. Zedekiah said to Jeremiah, I am afraid. He's afraid of the Judeans who have deserted the Chaldeans. He's afraid that if he surrenders to the Babylonians, some of his fellow Jews who have already gone across to the Babylonians might abuse him and mistreat him. So he has a command. He's afraid. He too has to trust God that God's commands are good and the best course of action, even when accompanied by significant dangers. But of course, he makes a different choice to Ebed-Melech, doesn't he? In Zedekiah's case, he is directed by, he's dictated by his fears rather than by the Lord's command, and he doesn't surrender to Nebuchadnezzar. In Ebed-Melech's case, he is dictated by the Lord's command, love your neighbours yourself, and he pulls Jeremiah out of the pit. He's not dictated by his fears. So that's the contrast between the two men. Both have a command from God, both afraid. One trusts God, that God's commands are good no matter what the dangers, the other doesn't. The other's too afraid to obey God. And there are times for us, aren't there, when obeying God is scary. Like telling customers or clients at work the truth, even when your boss doesn't want you to tell them the truth. Obeying God then, obeying the eighth commandment then, is scary. Standing up for the biblical definition of marriage in a society where the biblical definition of marriage is increasingly a bigoted concept. Again, that's scary. And in such cases then, we too, like Ebed-Melech, we need to trust God, don't we, that his commands are good and they are the best course of action, even when accompanied by significant dangers. In those cases, it's not just straightforward obeying God. It's trusting that God's commands are good and right and the best course of action. So we've seen in the timing of his intervention and the motive of his intervention. Thirdly, and finally, the nature of his intervention. The nature of his intervention. Well, you say that's obvious. He pulls Jeremiah out of the system. And yes, he certainly does. But it's just interesting, isn't it, the way in which he does it. He doesn't do it in the most efficient manner possible. I mean, as we've already said, this was a dangerous business. He could have wanted to do it as quickly as possible in case anybody saw him. But no, he doesn't go about it in that manner. We're told, aren't we, in verse 11 of him heading off then to the house of the king, to a wardrobe in the storehouse, and you assume he's looking for ropes. That's the one thing surely he's going to need. He's going to need ropes to get him out. But that's not actually what he's looking for there. He took from there old rags and worn out clothes. And this isn't just one of those rather quaint little details that you sometimes get in biblical narratives that don't really serve that much purpose within the narrative as a whole, because it's repeated in the next verse as an emphasis on these rags and clothes being used in the rescue of Jeremiah. There's an emphasis then that Ebed-Melech approached this in a very careful, a very painstaking, a very detailed manner. We can put it as simply as possible, he was concerned even for Jeremiah's armpits. And he really has then appreciated the scope, hasn't he, of love your neighbour as yourself. Because you think again of Jesus' interpretation of that in that parable in Luke chapter 10. The Samaritan who rescues the injured man. And he doesn't just kind of pick him up, get him off the roadside and make sure he can walk a few steps and then leg it somewhere. But he's so painstaking, isn't he? So detailed, so careful. He binds the man's wounds. He pours on oil and wine. He takes him to an inn and pays the money that will be necessary and promises more if required. There's that attention to detail. Because Jesus is saying, that's what love your neighbor means. It's not just doing the bare minimum. It's loving with care and lavish attention. And Ebed-Melech seems to understand something of that. And that challenges us, doesn't it? How, well, first of all, do we help others? That's the most basic thing. Is there that spirit of Ebed-Melech, that spirit of the Samaritan in us at all, even to stop, to help others? Generally, are we looking out for those that we can help? But then how do we help them? Just with the bare minimum that can salve our consciences and tick the box, yes, we've done our good deeds? Or is it this Samaritan-like, Ebed-Melech-like, attentiveness, care, love? Are we even concerned for the armpits of those that we are helping? But then just, I don't think we can close without saying one more thing about this. It's interesting that this word then, cistern, that we have several times in our passage, it's a fairly common word within the Old Testament, and particularly in the book of Psalms, where it's generally translated not cistern, but pit. And in those Psalms, it seems often to be equated with death. Psalm 30 is a particularly obvious example. In Psalm 30 and verse 3, David says, O Lord, you have brought up my soul from Sheol. And we all know Sheol then, the realm of the dead in the Old Testament. You restore me to life among those who go down to the pit. And it's the same word we have here in this passage. So the pit there is equated with Sheol. It's a description of death. And perhaps then it's not illegitimate to see in Ebed-Melech the rescuer of Jeremiah from the pit, a foreshadowing of the Redeemer. We know he's written all over the scriptures, isn't he? The Redeemer who rescues his people from the pit of Psalm 30, death, the Lord Jesus Christ. That's included, isn't it? That's almost the climax, the epitome of our redemption. If we are Jesus' people this evening, it doesn't just address a few little problems we have in our lives. It addresses even that massive problem that's looming over all of us, whatever age we are this evening. Death. Jesus' salvation, Jesus' redemption addresses that. He is the one who doesn't simply kind of lift us out of a few little holes. He even ultimately will lift us out of the pit itself, out of death, out of Sheol. He will resurrect us. What a redeemer. And perhaps then Ebed-Melech, just in a very, very small way, foreshadows him. And of course, he too, Jesus, in his redeeming work, like Ebed-Melech, is so attentive to detail, isn't he? He goes the extra mile, just like Ebed-Melech does here. You think of Revelation 7, and that wonderful picture then of the multitude no man can number, that's been gathered from every nation, tribe, people and language, and they're there now, resurrected. This is the consummation, this is the age to come, they've been raised from the dead. And you think, well, that's enough. I mean, they've been raised from their lives of curse, those lives of tears and hardship and struggle here on earth, and they've been raised now, all that's over, and they're happy now, that's enough, surely. And yet we have this redemption going a step further, and Revelation 7 ending with that wonderful touch that God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Not merely raising them out of the curse, but even then addressing every hurt, every pain, every tear that they've ever experienced, compensating in some beautiful divine way for every single wound and every single hurt. And it's again this Ebed-Melech like going further than seems necessary. And that, of course, is our salvation full stop, isn't it? It's a redemption that just goes beyond, it surpasses, it exceeds anything that could be expected. If God had simply saved us from going to hell, I mean, that would be amazing, wouldn't it? Like if Ebed-Melech had just said, well, I'll lift you up out of the pit and I'll chuck a rope down for you and get you out. Well, that would have been good. But there's the rags, the old clothes, there's the protection to make it easier, make it better. And God's salvation, it's more than just rescuing us from hell. He brings us into fellowship with himself, into a relationship with Father, Son, and Spirit. He brings us into a life of knowing himself, and it's so far beyond anything that could be expected or envisaged. And so in then the kind of overplus here in Ebed-Melech's treatment of Jeremiah, I'm saying we're getting a little picture of the God who redeems us with an overplus, not just the bare minimum, but lavishing upon us so much more than we could ever have imagined. What a God we have. Amen. Well, we're going to close with a hymn that takes us to that.